It is Saturday, July 17th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is from Dave Patera. If you'd like to participate by making a theme for Geek Speak, we'd love to play it on air. And also, we take imagery for our website. Geek Speak is a Creative Commons endeavor. Share and share alike. Attribution, share and share alike. You're welcome to reuse it for anything you like, as long as you give us attribution. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is a software engineer and political junkie, Miles Elam. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Al Luckow, who is a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hi, everybody.
In just a sec, we're doing Geek News in the first half of the show. We'll probably take calls in the second half. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Al's next story, which is exciting, is a story about bionic legs. But first, Miles, what's going on with you?
Unfortunately, I couldn't cover the story last week because I was at the Amazing Meeting 8, which we're going to be doling out highlights of that for the next few weeks. But yeah. In the meantime, this story I still thought deserved mention, which is a solar plane has completed the first ever 24-hour flight. Now, this is a plane that has photovoltaic cells on the top surface of the wing, and it's able to get enough power so that during nighttime when there isn't any sunlight, the batteries can still keep it aloft. The
cool.
fact that they've done it for 24 hours means that they've gone through the full cycle, so potentially, or at least theoretically, the aircraft could stay in the air indefinitely.
Until the batteries stop keeping a charge, right?
Until the batteries right. stop keeping a
really
charge.
Really cool.
Assuming that you don't, find some other battery technology
is this a
capacitor or something like that. Yes, it's manned.
Wow.
So there's a guy in there.
Yes.
Wow.
This isn't going to replace jet engines, your typical passenger jet anytime soon. It doesn't have anywhere near that capacity as yet. But it's still a nice stepping stone, and it also... there's also now a proof of concept that you have a plane that doesn't have the same emissions that a typical plane does, which flying from city to city is atrocious with regard to the amount of CO2 emissions.
Yeah, of course. But the speed is way too slow for any kind of...
Depends useful. On if you have a headwind or a tailwind, I guess.
I guess so.
It must be like a propeller plane?
Yes,
or?
It is. It's a prop plane.
Oh, interesting. Very cool. Do you know what kind of batteries it is?
I actually don't know what types of batteries.
Energizer batteries, I think.
Yeah, it's like the bunny. Because, I guess the good big question is you want something that's light, and you also want something that I would assume would be reliable.
Right. Coming from this person here who knows nothing really about battery chemistry or aeronautics, I still would say that I would think a lithium polymer, because those are really lightweight but still have a very high
right. That makes sense.
Density.
Yeah. That's a good completely guess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It makes me sound like I know what I'm doing.
Almost.
Time to be investing in lithium, I think.
Well, we'll have some more mileage and travel topics in a second when we hear about mileage on the moon. But first, what's the story about bionic legs?
Well, this is a story about a company who's developed sort of a bulky but cool contraption that can be strapped to the legs and waist of a person who can't walk, like somebody who was paralyzed from the waist down or something. Mm-hmm. And it can slowly allow them to stand up and walk. Now, if you watch the video that I'll post on geekspeak.org, it might only be vaguely interesting, especially when you see how slow these things are. And for that matter, we see things like this so much in movies like Avatar or Matrix. We just assume that, you know, exoskeletons like this exist somewhere. But the fact is they don't.
Unfortunately.
Right. The device that I ran across here is called REX, and that's short for Robotic Exoskeleton. And it's the name of the robotic pants developed by REX Bionics. The test subject shown in the video where they demonstrate this thing hadn't walked in 5 years. Now, REX Bionics was founded by two men, friends, Richard Little and Robert Irving. They were engineers originally from Scotland. These guys had been friends all through engineering school, and together they moved to New Zealand. They both have mothers who use wheelchairs, and when Robert Irving received a diagnosis for multiple sclerosis just over 7 years ago, he understood that he might also need to use a wheelchair one day, so they decided to tackle the idea of a walking alternative to wheelchairs. Now, when you watch the interview with the test subject, whose name is Hayden, he describes his mind just teeming with the possibilities. But aside from the breathtaking feeling of walking again, it also helps a lot of other health issues for people who sit in wheelchairs. Like, there's all sorts of, like, kidney and bladder problems you get from sitting in wheelchairs all day and things like that. But as I watched the video and I saw Hayden pull himself out of his wheelchair and get into this thing, it really started to look different to me. It started to look like one of those old cell phones from the 70s that was either in a small suitcase or the blender-sized hunk of plastic that was deemed portable in the 80s.
Right.
To me, this is the birth of something great, and it's just a matter of time before this device is engineered to fit under some baggy pants. This, to me, is engineering at its finest, working to improve the human condition. The device itself is due to launch in 2011, but seeing things like this, it just, you know, once you watch this video, you're like, this is going to allow people to walk again, people who haven't either, have been paralyzed. It just seems like this is the kind of problem where you just dump a bunch of engineers on it and they just improve it.
Yeah.
You know, I could just see this thing in 5 years, you know.
The psychological thing of a wheelchair, you know, always being lower than people, other people are standing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Dean Kamen talked about this on his iBot.
Right.
Is that what the Yeah, the iBot, the Segway iBot.
Uh-huh.
Dean Kamen is the inventor of the Segway, which everyone knows is kind of a lazy man's walking tool, right?
Yeah.
But one of the things that's really interesting is that the technology put into that was all about being able to standing wheelchair was one of the first things he built.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the motors and everything to do that are kind of complicated. Now it's pretty standard, that whole idea. And the iBot, which was the wheelchair that could stand, basically was a four-wheel wheelchair that was electrical, and then you'd push a button and it would do its two-wheel Segway type thing where it would stand and the person would get up to a natural standing human height even though they're sitting in a wheelchair, and this just kind of takes another step. But the big thing about that, the people that were paraplegic that could use this thing, all of a sudden they could have a conversation eye level.
Right.
Very good thing.
And you know, whatever they do in the house, even and right now this thing, you know, this REX product,
it's bulky.
It's bulky. It looks kind of neat. It looks like legs that kind of attach to the outside of your legs. It looks kind of cool. You know, it kind of reminds me of that Wallace and Gromit movie, the Wrong Trousers. But, you know, I mean, this is the first step, you know, for something like this. So I think this REX device is really something to watch.
It's amazing that we can build it.
Yeah.
We had the technology.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing we haven't built it already, actually, if you ask me.
Yeah, that's kind of... Yeah. We have covered a couple stories about kind of power armor type situations where we talked about, I think it was a military... design thing,
right.
But it was sensing where your arm goes and just
people who could already move their
legs.
That was
the thing about it. Of course, it was. Yeah. You had to move
yourself. And this thing is controlled through controls from the. It's like a joystick on the hand, so you don't have to. Your legs can just be like,
just strapped in.
Just strapped in.
Yeah, it's very cool. All right, thanks for that story.
Mm-hmm.
And in a second, you are going to talk about mileage on the moon, right? But first, Miles, what's your next story? I don't see it up here. Are you ready for me?
Yes, I am ready for you. Good. I'm just keeping it a
secret.
It's
a mystery.
Yes.
A mysterious entry from Miles Elon.
Basically, a congratulations for doing something awesome, and then a wag of the finger at someone who's doing something not awesome.
All right, what's the awesome?
The awesome, and this has been covered in some other outlets, but if GeekSpeak didn't cover it,
Where would we be? Right.
It's that the current Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, publishes research papers while he's the Energy Secretary. He still is publishing to further the expanse of science. So he published a article to the scientific journal Nature called Sub-Nanometer Single Molecule Localization, Registration, and Distance Measurements.
This is what he's doing in his side time?
Right.
So this is a government employee that is actually continuing to work after being hired into a political office.
Well, this is the thing is that his response when asked about it was he doesn't watch TV. He doesn't do many of the things that we might do to relax. His relaxation is working on theoretical physics.
Which doesn't seem that odd to us.
No, not at all. That's what I do, actually, in my spare time.
And no,
so he's not watching television and instead... Read the paper title again. It's great.
Sub-nanometer single molecule localization, registration, and distance measurements.
Cool. So it's finding out where a molecule is and how far away it is from something else. Cool. Thank you.
Excellent.
What's the wag of the finger?
Which is also...
Same guy.
Tangentially to the political sphere.
Okay. Different.
Which is the Huffington Post. Which has been a big
force. They're not doing biology. They're not doing physics. Physics.
With regard to politics, they've been a big force in getting information out. And they talk about we need to call the opposition on their logic. We need to show where this isn't true and this is. And yet they have a huge amount of pseudoscience up on their site, and. They have, and when asked about it, there's no comment. They don't care, even though scientists will come up saying, "Yeah, the stuff you have on there, it's to use a skeptical term, it's woo. it's nonsense. It's stuff that doesn't have."
So what you're saying is normally they'll tell a relatively fair story and they'll describe the points about it. They'll do a news kind of thing, and then some of their posts have nothing to do with that.
As they hit something like medicine or
do you have
crime
examples of what kind of stuff they're posting?
This is Huffington Post, right?
Yes.
The Huffington Post.
Yeah.
Yes.
I thought that was like sort of like an Inquirer kind of thing for England. You know how in England they talk about like...
Oh, no. It's well respected in the blogosphere.
Huh.
I can't believe I just said that, but yeah, I mean, it was
for
kind
the
of
political
the,
commentary.
Yeah, I mean, the truth about the Huffington Post is as it emerged as kind of a powerhouse, it kind of defined
a left-wing powerhouse. Yeah, so to make it clear that they are quite partisan. They're not apologetic.
But it became a source for, you know, it became a large media outthrow, and it was only done by individuals. It wasn't. I don't think it was owned by a large corporation. I think it was what's her first name?
Ariana
Huffington. Started writing. Other people joined her, and it became a powerhouse of news. But it is left-wing, and you're also saying that sometimes they present non-factual information.
They present things like homeopathy and presenting the term presenting the concept of water has memory.
Right, which isn't
like,
true.
However you might feel about homeopathy, even though it's basically pure water, however you might feel about it or its effects or if it's placebo effect or not,
or that's however it works.
That's stuff you would discuss. But as soon as you get into that... There are all these studies that show that it works. No, they aren't peer-reviewed. They aren't double-blind studies.
They're not good scientific studies. Right. And on top of that, the whole idea behind it that memory has water, there's no reason for that. There's no
on the contrary,
behind that.
To say memory, water has memory is to say that our knowledge of physics is fundamentally wrong. Not like we've missed something, but is fundamentally wrong. Right. That same physics... that allows cell phones to work, or the same physics that would allow us to send a probe to other planets.
Or that our Department of Energy guy, is that who he is?
Right.
Measures molecule
Stephen
distance.
Chu,
he wouldn't be able to do that kind of stuff unless we knew what we were doing.
Well, it's not that we know what we're doing. The idea of water having memory can't happen unless everything else that has been shown and demonstrated to be right is wrong.
I love the way a geek presents this. It's like, that's not possible unless everything we know is wrong. Well, the better way to say that, in my opinion, is that's not possible because we have so much data saying this is how the world works that to say memory has water is ridiculous.
Well, that's why I was saying it would not have been possible for us to send probes to other planets.
Right.
They wouldn't have been able to get off the ground.
We know that that's not how it works.
Right.
Basically. Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. So you're saying the Huffington Post on some of its science or non-science entries or medical entries is pretty bad.
Right, and putting stuff up that is wrong isn't, you know, horrible in and of itself. I mean, everybody makes mistakes. We've posted stuff that was wrong before.
I've
we've said stuff
anything,
on air.
Nothing wrong.
But at the same time, even when they've been contacted by various scientific advocates, by scientists and the like, saying, here's the reason why this isn't right. This is,
nothing.
Completely ignored.
It's probably, it probably has a bit to do with the way the structure is that the Huffington Post, it's probably attributed and even copyrighted by individuals that post, right? So there's people that are respected enough to post on their site. It's something probably like that. Like right now, if you went and made a blog entry on the GeekSpeak website and someone made a complaint about it, I'd be like, if Miles isn't responding, I mean, you know, that's Miles' entry. It's not mine. You know, so there's a bit of that probably going on. But it is an interesting dilemma. I mean, how do you decide what is valid? I remember having a lot of respect for the Huffington Post. I'm pretty left-wing for a long time. And then hearing in the kind of skeptic movement about how bad some of their science posts is, well, I don't ever go there for medical information, right? That's not someplace I'd go. I go for political analysis. That's why I would read Huffington.
But that's the thing, though. Once you're there, I was totally aware.
Yeah, and that's the thing is as soon as I started hearing a lot of negativity from the skeptic movement about the Huffington Post, I was like, why? There's a great, you know, political commentary mm-hmm. there. And then you start looking at the articles, you're like, oh, because it's scientifically really bad. And that's a sad thing to see.
Right. When you're talking about the vetting process, there is a vetting process. I can't go to that site and just post something.
No,
I would need to be vetted first. And so there is a vetting process, and it's not working.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for the update on the Huffington Post. And the secretary, which secretary is it?
Energy secretary.
Energy secretary. What's his
name? One that would, technology would and science would really come in handy.
Yeah.
We've got a hardcore, ready-to-go scientist as opposed to just a political hack in the office. And that's awesome.
Very cool. So what's going on the moon, Al?
Well, I don't know if you knew this, but on January 15th, 1973, the Russians sent a vehicle to the moon.
I wasn't alive. Sorry.
Oh, okay. I was.
Therefore, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Although I don't remember.
Well, he said, I don't know if you remember this. Well, I couldn't remember.
But, you know, when the Russians did something in the 70s.
Everybody knew about it.
Well, they didn't really talk about it too much. But this was a vehicle called the Lunokha 2, and it drove around on the moon and took TV images and sent them back down to, like, a team of, like, five guys in a control booth, and they were able to take pictures and do
things. Did they keep the footage?
Yeah, I have no idea, but it just drove around and after a period of driving, it would stop and it would charge its batteries using the sun when it came around, and then it would charge up again and drive around some more.
Wow, this is 73.
Yeah, this is 73, cool. And one day at one point the Russians decided that this project is completed. The mission has been completed, which basically means that, well, this thing's not working anymore, so it's over. So the thing just kind of, pooped out up there. And it's speculated that the rover's open lid touched a crater wall, and it covered it with dust. And then when the lid closed, it got into the radiators, and the thing overheated. And it just, somehow it just died out, and it was gone, and nobody, whatever
and
happened.
And no mechanics.
It's just gone, Well, it operated for about 4 months.
Wow.
And it drove 23 miles
on
the moon, which happens to be the longest journey any robotic rover has ever taken on another celestial body,
including Mars.
Yes,
Spirit and Opportunity haven't gone that far. Wow.
Exactly. By comparison, the rover Opportunity had traveled only 12 miles.
Wow!
So this was in 73. So it's the longest thing. And another little interesting twist to the story is that more recently, March 17th, 2010, Phil Stuck, a professor at the University of Western Ontario, announced that he had located the Lunokha 2's final resting place in photographs made by the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So they released all these high-res versions of it, and he's like looking through all these moon things, and he sees this like trail of where, these little tracks, and then sees this like dead like robot. on
right.
the moon. So he found this thing, and it's kind of, interesting. But then, just to make this story even a little more interesting, the ownership of the Lunokha 2 is another thing. That it was actually purchased by a guy in December of 1993 at a Sotheby's auction in New York. So somebody bought...
Wait, before they knew where it was?
Yeah, they knew it was on the moon somewhere.
Right, the address, moon.
And yeah, it was up there, and they were pretty sure.
He bought it at a Sotheby's auction.
So the Russians sold this thing, even though it's on the moon, And the guy who bought it is Richard Garriott. He's also known as Lord British.
He's the guy that went up in space in the mirror, right?
Yes. In October of 2008, he went up on the Soviet station. He was the first self-funded space tourist.
He was a tourist, yeah.
Yeah. Right. His father was Owen Garriott, who was an astronaut. Yeah.
Okay, I was about to ask why he bought it, but, you know, he doesn't need reasons.
Well, he apparently is very wealthy. He's been well-known in the video game industry and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, his dad was the astronaut on Skylab and space shuttles and stuff. Anyway, so this guy bought this dead robot in space, and his reasoning was so that he could become the world's only private owner of an object on a foreign celestial body.
Oh, that's cool. That's good enough reason, I guess.
So, I mean, this is a little weird thing, but kind of a little bit of history of lunar driving.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks. Miles, got any more news about, I don't know, electric planes or
cars? Yes.
Yeah?
About cars.
Okay.
There's been some concern in some circles that if you dump a whole bunch of electric cars on the American market, you're going to overload the U.S. power grid.
Really?
The idea...
Who's concerned about this?
Well, there are some folks talking about it. I mean, the idea is if you have millions of cars showing up and suddenly you have a new draw on energy grid, especially from a culture that drives as much as we do, some people kind of raise the question, is that going to be a problem? Well, it turns out when looking at the actual problem and looking at the numbers, the answer is no, they won't.
In fear of bringing down the power grid.
Right. They found that the amount of charging a car over a period of time is about equal to about 4 or 5 plasma TVs.
That's fine.
And, that amount of load, we're not thinking, oh my God, big screen TVs are going to bring down the apocalypse.
You shouldn't be watching TV while you're driving.
That is true.
Especially on 4 plasma screens.
Yeah.
That wouldn't make sense at all. Your car can't handle that kind of power.
Even for a geek, that's too much.
But the load of one plug-in car charging is about 2 kilowatts.
Okay. Well, that's kind of a lot, actually.
But that's 4 or 5 plasma TVs. So it's a lot in terms of your energy bill.
Or 1.5 toasters.
Yeah. It's for your energy bill, it might be a fair amount, which is an incentive to charge your car at night, which is then when you don't have as much demand, which means that it's just leveling out the power draw day and night.
Charge at night, you're okay, basically. It's interesting. The 2 kilowatts, that means you're going to have to get... you're going to have to get another circuit because
most people, when they have an electric car, they need a special charging station for their house.
You're going to have to get a plug garage, rated higher than 15 amps. Yeah. Okay, cool. It's good to know. And so we're safe, you're saying.
We should be fine.
And of course,
and we'll definitely be safer than we are driving
your electricity
fossil
bills,
fuel powered cars.
Right, definitely. And your electricity bill is going to go up, but your gas bill is going to disappear. So you're pretty okay.
Right. And even with plug-in hybrids, you're reducing your gas consumption dramatically.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Are you going to convert your Prius into a plug-in?
Am I going to convert it?
Yeah.
If convert is sooner or later traded in for something else, sure. But
the capitalistic conversion.
Yeah. As sad as it is, I did not follow my father's footsteps. I am not an electrical engineer. So.
Too bad.
But you don't have a Tesla on order or anything?
I'm not that rich. I thought you were.
In a second, non-ugly wind turbines, which don't chop up birds. That's very cool. We'll let Miles address the bird chopping up thing. It's great. Meow. Listen, you're listening to Geek Speak on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly hour-long radio quiz program. Each week on the radio, you can test your knowledge against some of the best and brightest in the news and entertainment world while figuring out what's real news and what's made up. On the web, you can play along, too. That's Wait, Don't Tell Me. Today at noon on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. So, anybody have a geek bit today? Miles, why don't you mention one TAM thing?
One TAM thing?
One TAM thing that you liked. TAM is the amazing meeting happened in Vegas last week. Ben and Miles went. They represented GeekSpeak, collecting interviews and great stories, I'm sure, and we'll be doing those on the show as we go. One thing that you thought was surprising or interesting from the show?
Well, just a quick tidbit. There were many things that were interesting about the show. It was chock full of stuff for 4 days, solid. So,
wow.
But one thing that was brought up that I had seen before, but it was still nice to hear about again, was Galaxy Zoo.
Yeah.
Which was, if you don't know what Galaxy Zoo is, you had a grad student who thought, okay, I need to catalog all of these astronomical features. And their PhD advisor was saying, okay, now look at these. I'll categorize this 500,000 block or 50,000 of them. And so he works on it for a month or so and comes back and goes, here we go. And goes, okay, now here's another 50,000. It's like, oh, God, this is... And so he goes to a pub, he starts drinking, runs into a friend of his who's a computer programmer and goes, well, why don't we just put it up on a website and have people just generally looking at it? And so the general public gets to look at really pretty items, but they're also doing science. But they don't think about doing it as science. They're doing it as, I'm looking at these really cool items.
Right. We covered the story a while ago. The benefit, of course, is that humans are actually pretty good at classifying things.
Yes.
So you're kind of asking the people that look at these pictures, is it swirling to the left or counterclockwise or clockwise? Is it how big is it? How bright is it? All these things that you kind of need to know, and that gets entered in the system.
But what I found most interesting was there were a couple of astronomical features that were theorized to exist, but had never been actually observed. And they were observed by these general public
awesome.
Looking at it, and the features got named after the person that discovered them. So if you get get on Galaxy Zoo, you get on another site that's doing some type of science aggregation, you could go down in the textbooks.
Cool. All right, that's a great geek bit. Thank you. And I put that up on the show website already. We got any more news stuff to cover? I guess what we'll do is, Miles, first off, will you please tell me why large turbines that are on top of hills that generate power aren't really that dangerous to birds, comparatively speaking?
The story came from one particular area where they had wind turbines, where it was a very narrow very narrow canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And you did have a high bird mortality, but it was not the case with most sites. And so to generalize that it is a danger for birds, it's like, well, no, the other 90% of wind turbine areas never had a problem, no matter what technology they were using, whether they were fast spinning blades or slow spinning blades or the like. And in addition to that, they have been working on making them safer, such as slowing the blade speed.
And to put that in context, when we covered this story years ago, you brought up the amount of birds that are killed by house cats every year. House cats, of course, which don't actually
generate electricity. Are probably the number one killer of birds.
Of avians, yeah.
On the planet. In general, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, non-natural, I guess, would be the best way to say that. Non-wild deaths.
Well, that's the thing. The wild cats...
There's not that many.
Well, aside from that, the wild cats, yes, will kill birds, but because it's their only source of food, they will only kill to eat. Because you're not going to waste energy
right. When
you don't have a steady supply of
food. But we're breeding killers.
Domestic cats, however, you'll feed them. They'll be eating the food. A bird will come by. They'll go and kill the bird and then go back and eat their food again.
Right, right.
So they're subsidized killers. There's no energy deficit that comes from just
Can
killing
something.
Can you
tell that Miles is a dog guy or not?
No, actually, we have two cats now.
You have cats?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm impressed. Do they get to stay in the house?
They stay outside the
house. Of course. Dogs can sleep on the bed. Don't put a cat in bed with Wyatt. I mean, with Miles. Excuse me. Gosh, why did I just do that?
Nothing happened to your cat.
Miles is staying at my place one night, and we've got a great cat, right? Real sweet and loving, and she goes under the blankets, and he wakes up in the middle of the night and almost kills it, thinking it's a rat. Stops.
It was 4 a.m. I wasn't awake. Did I kill your cat? No. Did I hurt your cat in any way? No.
So is there a way to make turbines that are less – I mean, the other thing about turbines up on the hillside is that they're not very attractive.
Right. Well, I don't know if you've ever heard the acronym NIMBY.
No.
It's NIMBY, not in my backyard.
Ah, yes. I've heard the phrase.
Now, that's the way people feel about wind turbines. And, you know, there's wind a lot of places, and you can convert that to energy. And it's unfortunate that, you know, in order to have – energy, you have to convert it. You have to have this gigantic fan that looks like a windmill, mm-hmm. you know, and in Holland, that's pretty accepted.
And not Dutch looking. I mean, that's the thing. They're wooden, yeah. like, kind right. of cool structure.
Yeah,
be different.
It would be all right, you
they're
know.
They're not very effective, I don't know.
Yeah. And if you're grinding grain, that's important. But recently, a company has, developed this device, and it's called Ridgeblade. It's a wind turbine solution from a UK-based group called the Power Collective. It's very simple. It's just a standalone windmill-like structure, but it's long blade. It's a long-bladed turbine that sits on the ridge of a building's roof. So if you think about the roof being kind of like a triangle, and right along the apex of that triangle, there's this like long thing that's got some fins in it, and that's where it pulls in the wind. So it is not unsightly. Birds don't get sucked into it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The blades are pretty long because they're still the length of the house. There's no thing sticking up. It's a really revolutionary.
You got pictures of this
approach?
Thing?
Yeah, I posted it on the site. It's the company has actually won $750,000 from the Green Challenge Awards because they've shown that yes, you can do wind power without making gigantic fans, ugly fans.
Right.
And it's kind of a neat solution. And, you know, you look at it and you think, oh, yeah, that looks like it would work. But, you know, nobody's done it before. It's just another one of those things where people just, you know, apply, you know, engineering skills
and
say, okay, here we can do this. It can look right. You can put it under your house and nobody, you know.
Miles?
A quick devil's advocate with regard to the ugliness concern.
Mm-hmm.
When I drive down, for example, to Moss Landing to go kayaking, I don't ever say, hey, look at that power station. That one's pretty.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
right.
Power generation is not, has never been.
Yeah, but the density.
This is home generation. This is generating it for your own home, not like generating power for like the grid.
No,
you know?
Granted, just talking about that aesthetics issue.
Well, the thing is, like a power generating plant, yeah, that's not very pretty, but it's normally not. There's not a lot of people can see it. Wind turbines, you got to put up on a hillside, so a lot of people can see it. I think mm-hmm. that's the reason why there's always a concern about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the power station, you kind of hide over there.
Yeah, my biggest concern was going over 152 and looking at how many wind turbines weren't turning.
Yes, then you always go, yeah, there's the flaw in the system.
It'd be neat, though, to have one of these, like, ridge turbines on the ridge of your roof, and then the front part of your roof to be solar panels.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
You know, then
you
got to
stack them up.
All, like, I'm all perfect and clean tech, and, you know. That would be
And the only problem you ever have really is when it's raining and it's just not windy.
Right.
You're like, oh,
but
forecast
then,
still day.
But if it were windy at night.
Let me ask you about these turbine things. They don't actually go into the attic or something? Or it's just
no,
they
stick
top?
Out.
They stick out on top. Okay, yeah,
they're actually, I don't know if you can see that.
Okay, we're looking at screens.
Yeah.
But it just kind of sits on top of the roof.
It just sticks on. You clamp it on the top of the apex of your roof.
Great, and there's a sound effect.
Yeah, that's the me hitting the mic. But there's three designs there, and it's kind of promising. I like this stuff.
Cool. Let's go ahead and take a call while we wait for other calls. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. James in Seaside, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yes, hello.
Hello, James.
I have a question. I'm a multimedia producer, worked on producing technology projects the last years, and I've been told on various occasions that you should not use periods in file names because some servers don't recognize them or that kind of thing. And I was wondering if that's still true.
It's still true that some places will have problems with that, but basically you won't run into that problem. The only thing is that, I mean, Miles, you go ahead and support me on this. I mean, the thing is, you can use a period in a file name. The one caveat is don't put a period and then don't only have one period unless it's the file extension. See, it gets too complicated. Don't use periods.
I just use underscores.
Underscores are hyphens.
I was actually thinking as long as you're not on Windows.
Well, even on Windows now, I think that even on a Windows machine, by default, the extension's hidden, so you can't really mess with the extension.
That's true.
So if you name the file something.doc, it's actually going to have another extension after that that you won't even see unless you turned on the preference to see that, in which case it would be problematic because it would be confusing. I would period. My specific point is don't use periods in files names.
Yeah. Period. I mean, as a rule, but it is a very interesting question, though, because it would be so much cooler to be able to use periods. I know
I use them all the time.
I develop a lot of stuff, it's like, boy, really, I'd like to use a period in this file name just to make it just cleaner and right.
I use periods all the time, and the way I use them, the way I use a dot or a full stop in a file name is when I'm actually appending more information into the file, which is actually kind of metadata. And to describe that, I'll talk about the show files that we make for the MP3s for the show. The MP3s for the show that goes up on the website that NPR snatches is a date and then a dot and then the encoding type of the MP3 file, so 64-bit kilobit, and then dot and the file name MP3. And the reason I do that is that that information is actually kind of meta information. It's information about the file. But in general, you might run into problems. I would say if you want to avoid it, don't use the period. That's my perspective on it.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Sorry, James.
Yeah, it's basically what I've been told before. Yeah. It's really not a problem, but it's...
Are you on a Mac or Windows machine?
Well, both. And that's kind of the point of these files. You know, they could be PDFs or going on websites or delivering to vendors. And people brought up that, at least in the past, that potentially they could get into a system where it could be an issue, and there's obviously...
You're most likely not going to run into a problem up on a web server. You pretty much have to have the right extension on a web server for the MIME types to work. So you're going to run into a problem unless you have the file ending in a dot, whatever the file type is. That's just going to be a standard problem if you put on a web server. So as long as you've got the real extension of the file format, the dot doc or the dot PDF on there at the very end, a web server is not going to care. Because almost all, unless it's a Windows web server, but almost all web servers are Unix, Apache, so you're going to be okay. Perfect. Okay, James?
One of the reasons I don't like using underscores is because a lot of times it gets underlined as a link, and then the underscore disappears, and so people can't really tell.
They can't see it. Yeah, that's true about an underscore. What you're saying is that the hyperlink that gets added to the bottom of it obscures the underscore.
Depending
on the font, yeah. So that's why dashes work pretty well. Of course, dashes, if you're used to reading and the file names are kind of something to read, it feels like an m-dash in there or a hyphen in there, and then you're stuck in thinking the file has a different name than it actually has. But that's a grammatical problem.
Yeah.
It's just the perils of code.
The thing is, you can use spaces on every operating system now supports spaces, no problem. The problem is when you put it up on a web server, the link turns into %20, shows up everywhere you have a space,
those
and that's
are
ugly.
Yeah, I hate those. These are esoteric things, and a lot of people are probably listening to this going, %20, what the heck are they talking about?
Actually, a lot of times they'll turn to pluses.
Pluses, too, sometimes that's true. Plus represents a space in the HTTP spec. Okay, thank you very much for the call.
Appreciate your time.
Take care.
Bye.
Okay, so we had an off-air comment, think about domestic cats are a hire, but we don't know the ends of it, so I don't know what that was, so we'll have to kill on. If you have perspectives about domestic cats killing birds, call up. Leave a message.
I probably should say before we get any more get any hate mail about this, indoor cats do not have this particular problem.
Full indoor cats.
Right.
Yes, you're right. That's true. Okay, so Bruce in Elkhorn, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yes, hi. Just a comment. There was a recent article from NASA that does their technical brief publications, and it was on windmills and windmill farms and the problems that they have, that you get dirty air basically from one windmill passing that air through to the ones beside it and behind it. So when you have more than one, because they've always been studied in isolation, when you have a real farm environment, you're much better off with the vertical ones where you don't have those problems. So they found when you cluster them and put whatever dozens or hundreds that the new the old vertical design that everybody sort of bypassed because they just started to go with bigger and bigger blades, that there are turbulence problems where you do get dirty air, and that once you get more than one, you're better off with a vertical design.
Okay. And when you're talking about turbulence, you're not talking about – I mean, when you're talking about dirty air, you're not talking about the quality of the air. You're talking about the movement of the air.
Well, it's like a small plane following by in a wake of a jet loses its lift because it's getting turbulent air. It's not getting smooth air.
Right.
So they refer to it as dirty air.
Interesting. I wonder why specifically – the rotating ones that are horizontal rotating versus vertical rotating.
Oh, because you're not going to get that turbulence. You know, if you think of like a propeller in the water where you get this wake that spreads out, you know, in a 60-degree arc, you're getting the same thing in the air from the turbine.
So everybody's been focused on how to make... why is the vertical better? It would seem like you'd do the same
effect. But it's more like a paddle wheel effect. If you think of it like a paddle wheel.
I see, right. So it's small.
It's narrow.
I see.
It's narrow. It's kind of like
it's
the same thing.
It's activating that vortex, if you will, that goes out to in all angles. So initially people kept looking at making bigger and bigger blades, and then how do you space them apart? And, of course, a lot of the offshore ones done in places like Holland and whatnot that, you know, predated the ones in the U.S., they had plenty of room to keep them spaced apart so they didn't see the effect.
Oh, interesting.
But as they're trying to do more and more windmill farms, especially places like Wisconsin, where I think 14% of the state's energy comes from wind, then they're seeing a dramatic increase where they want to increase the density. But this is a problem. So this is where they've seen that the vertical allow them to put more windmill generators per acre.
Right. Cool. Thank you, Bruce.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Bye. Bruce from Elkhorn adding in his geek knowledge. If you have more information for us, please give us a call and share it with everyone. The question from Margaret, a comment from Margaret, was that she's saying that wind turbines threaten specific species, endangered species, are more so threatened. Now, I'm not sure if that there's studies behind that. That's one of the concerns about wind turbines, of course, is that species are in danger, you know, can be damaged by them, birds. And it's true that it's very, you know, you have something giant spinning in the air and in an environment. If there's a migratory flock that comes through and it can get hurt, we definitely want to not, you know, avoid that kind of thing.
Absolutely, that is a concern there. At the same time, it's not a you have wind turbines or you don't. It's you have wind turbines or you have the equivalent fossil fuel power generation. And if you're talking about extinctions.
Right. And all of them,
what
we're basically talking about is that all power sources have some kind of drawbacks. And, you know, solar power, everyone's like, solar power is great, great, great. But really, when you look at how to make a solar cell right now, the amount of energy put into it, the amount of chemical waste and all these bad things.
Photovoltaic
cell, excuse me. You've got a lot of side effects that aren't very appealing. And every one of those is pretty bad. When you actually start analyzing it, Miles and I have analyzed pretty well, nuclear looks pretty good, actually, compared to fossil fuels.
And so does solar thermal.
Yeah.
If you're making something that's just basically a group of mirrors focusing on a point to generate heat energy to turn a steam engine. I mean, that's
beautiful in a lot of ways. Yeah. Or especially, I mean, the thing that's kind of crazy, we don't have thermo-solar for our heating of our homes. I mean, everybody gets a little bit of, you know, to have a water heater on the roof.
Yeah, solar water heaters.
Those are really efficient because, of course, making heat from electricity is a pretty brute force way of doing heat. Well, we've got some more calls, so let's go ahead and start taking them. I feel like I've got too many hands going on here on the board. Okay. Dana Ullman, welcome from Berkeley. What's your question today?
Well, a friend of mine who's a professor at UC Santa Cruz just called me to say that someone there was bashing the Huffington Post.
Oh, good.
Because I've been one of the health writers for the Huffington Post, writing a lot about natural medicine and homeopathic medicine. I can and will respond to any of your concerns.
Well, unfortunately, Miles and I are not experts on the lack of scientific knowledge around homeopathy. So it would be kind of an unfair debate. You and I would debate, and you probably have a lot of that stuff nailed. And I would, I don't even really want to debate it in a lot of sense. Unfortunately,
we don't have to. But let's just talk in general. But
I'm not going to give you a platform to talk about homeopathy.
No. I'm not going to talk about homeopathy.
So how do you guys decide what journal entries can go up on the Huffington Post?
How do I decide what goes up on the Huffington Post? I'm not a decision maker. I'm not an editor. I'm just a writer there.
Okay.
And I'm one of the people that writes with a fair amount of references to what are called high-impact medical and scientific journals.
Mm-hmm.
And just what my experience is that there are certain people who I call medical fundamentalists. I don't even give them the dignity of calling them skeptics because I have too much respect for the term skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, medical fundamentalists are people that deny evidence, cherry-pick evidence, and determine what is real and not real based on limited review of the scientific literature. So
that's an absolutely fair comment to say that absolutely. Just because we don't know how something is going to function, that it still deserves a lot more research. It still deserves a lot more in terms of looking. It's more of the areas where, like homeopathy, if we're going to whip a dead horse there, that have gone under the review, that have had the research done on it and haven't shown anything besides the placebo effect. Consistent.
Actually, you know something? I don't know what literature you look at, but it's not the broad body of both basic science literature or clinical evidence. What happens is that one study was published in The Lancet in 2005 that has been thoroughly discredited, but a lot of people simply believe. Now, mind you, The Lancet has also published reviews of research on homeopathy that have been very positive. So you can choose The Lancet's review or the British Medical Journal's review, which is also very positive, or you can choose
one. Wait a second. I'm sorry. We can't do this.
Okay.
What you're saying when they say that those are positive, that's debatable. So even to get into this, I have to have more knowledge in the house to do this effectively. From what the people that I respect in this field that have looked into this, homeopathy is completely bunk. And I know it's completely unfair for me to be on the mic and have the board and be able to pot you down and turn you off at any point, but I can't let you go ahead and say, wait, I'm not going to turn you off. Okay, I guess he hung up.
Well, I'm not here.
Our board. Sorry about that.
So what I'm saying is that I don't want to go into stating case studies because I don't have enough knowledge behind me to argue.
I'm not talking about case studies. I was only talking about controlled basic science research and controlled double-blind placebo-controlled clinical trials.
And I can't address those.
I'll give you an example. It would be irresponsible for someone to say that antibiotics are not effective for infective diseases just because they're not effective for viral diseases.
Right.
Okay? So you see, a bunch of the research that has shown that homeopathy doesn't work has been badly designed studies that are set up specifically to disprove it.
Excuse me just a second. Dana, homeopathy comes this idea. I want everyone to be really clear about what we're talking about. If you take something that's bad for a person or causes a certain disease and you dilute it to so much so that there's not even a molecule left in the water, and then you give it to that person, the theory is that that's going to benefit them. This is made up by a guy, I can't remember, Homian.
I agree with you entirely.
And his idea is insane. It doesn't have any
merit. By your oversimplistic, inadequately informed point of view, I would agree with you.
But that's the basic principle. That's the basic principle of homeopathy. That's what we're talking about.
Here's another way to look at it.
That basic principle is ridiculous on its merit.
Here's another way to look at it. Symptoms of disease are defenses. Symptoms are, if you believe in evolution, symptoms are our adaptive force, our effort to survive. By giving homeopathic medicines, although they might seem to be small, are hardly small. You wouldn't call the atomic bomb small. Even though there's those little atoms
you're throwing crazy ideas out to argument your case. The point is that when you dilute it that much, there's not even one molecule left in the water. But you're shaking it and diluting it.
Are you familiar with the physics don't agree hypothesis with you. And the effect?
The physics doesn't agree with your idea of how this works. Well, it doesn't
actually
make sense. Miles, you want to get in here for a second?
The Nobel Prize winner in 2008 was the guy that discovered the HIV virus, the French virologist Luc Montagnier. He just spoke last month to a group of Nobel laureates, specifically about his new work, which has major implications on homeopathy. This is discussed at Wikipedia.
Arguing from authority does not denote your argument.
Don't you hate it when you argue from...
Miles, do you want to say something? Dana, hang on a second.
Talking about something, it's not necessarily argument from authority because he is talking about someone who is in the medical research field. So,
he's a biologist.
Right. So,
I mean, if I talk about research,
wait a second,
you say,
Dana,
you don't
please.
Know it?
Hang on a second.
All right. So, I think that is a fair comment to say, but at the same time, to say that person was bringing up, it's the research that they bring up, not necessarily the
research may have validity, yes.
But I do grant your point there. However, it is true that homeopathy, its basic principles are water has memory, and that like cures like. That
well,
if you
like
have
cures
a
like is the basis of, you know, immunizations. And
no,
now
it absolutely no, it's not. It's not is thing, not. It is absolutely
well,
not.
You know, let's sorry. Move on to
if
another call.
If you believe the father of immunology, he said it does. Dr. Emil Adolf von Behring.
Okay, let me explain.
Another Nobel Prize winner, by the way.
That's great. And he did some amazing work, and that stuff works. Homeopathy doesn't, unfortunately.
Immunology, it's not like. It's you have two molecules, virus particle that looks like another one, and therefore the body knows how to react to it.
That's right. It trains the immune system to
that
see
is
a threat.
Not
it's not
like
what homeopathy
lock.
Is doing. Homeopathy has no claim but that.
Something has a similar symptom. That's a different thing. Ball of wax.
Dana, thank you for the call.
Good luck.
Bye-bye. We might have time for one more call. Yeah, I think so. Hal from Santa Cruz, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. Well, that was fascinating. it shows how much the kinds of words and kinds of arguments and comparisons and so on, it opens up for a discussion, which I encourage you to have sometime.
I agree.
About what's called science and technology studies, which is sort of meta-dialogue about science and society. But I was calling about the previous discussion.
Wind.
Where one of you made a comment that the wind generator, if it weren't there, would have to be replaced by the power plant. And the comment is simply not an argument with that statement, but that statement assumes that there's the same demand and that it will be met by one of those two or an alternative source. The more useful way to think about the whole problem, I think, is to reduce the demand.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier and so much less costly. Our homes are so inefficient. Our motor vehicle transport system is so inefficient. Europeans and Japanese are twice as efficient.
Hal, we don't disagree with you at all. Of course, right. Reduction is the easiest way to
and
solve the problem.
Also, I wasn't actually saying we need to make the wind turbines or it's going to be a fossil fuel. I think the wind turbines are actually displacing the fossil fuel. So the idea is even if we reduce, adding more wind turbines means less fossil fuels in the overall pie. That was my point, not that we were trying to add on to or trying to advocate.
No, I wasn't commenting on that. I just wanted to throw out the notion that
reduction.
We assume a certain demand, and all the projections on power supply requirements assume it will grow at the rate at which it's grown with additional population and technology. And then we get ourselves in trouble by letting that happen rather than really focusing on keeping that from happening.
Agreed. I totally agree with you. Thank you, Hal, for the call.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, in a second, the USB of the week, the crazy USB of the week. And I think we will talk about homeopathy on this show in the future, but more on the point of how to debate science, like how you come up with well, we've done this to some degree, too.
Well,
it's a hard topic to
and
cover on a non-medical show.
And then have a bunch of the studies so we can look at them side by side and go which ones were in a double-blind study, which ones are advocacy, which ones were,
We should do a merge with Dr. Don, I think.
Yeah.
That would be great. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics and offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. Miles Elam's in the house today. Rick was answering phones. And Al Luckow.
Well, we've had a lot of discussion about important topics like wind turbines generating power and the homeopathy thing and the exoskeleton legs giving people the ability to walk again and all that kind of stuff. But now I want to get to something really important. The USB chicken burger for Port Hub. Okay, this is a hub, a USB hub, that plugs into your computer. And the thing looks like a chicken burger with a bun.
So is the patty square?
It's a round bun with a chicken burger. It looks like some sort of breading. And it's got a fake lettuce on it. And it's got four ports where you can stick your little USB key fobs in there. And it's got a bun top with fake sesame seeds on it. All right. And so this is a hub that sits on your next to your computer that you can plug your little USB key fobs into. It's shaped like a chicken burger. It's made of poly resin. You can use it on Mac and Windows.
Oh, good.
And this is truly an important thing that's destined to change the face of computing today. It's the USB chicken burger four port hub.
Thank you very much, Al. Mm-hmm. That's Al Luckow, new media architect.